Salon at 615 presents best-selling authors free to the public through a unique partnership between Nashville Public Library, Humanities Tennessee, Parnassus Books, and the Nashville Public Library Foundation. This Salon at 615 was recorded live at the Nashville Public Library.
Hello, you Nashville cats. I'm so happy. Right. I'm thrilled to be here. And I don't really come to Nashville that often. So, you know, we all have our ideas about cities, what they're really like, you know, what New Yorkers are like. And so I'm imagining, of course, that all of you are musicians. Right, just hanging around waiting for your studio time. But, you know, really, I know that's not really true. Some of you are sound engineers, right? What I do know about all of you is that you care about books. And I think you are so lucky to have Ann Patchett and Parnassus and all of the people who work at Parnassus Books. You may not realize what an increasingly rare gift it is to have an independent bookstore in your town. So thank you for remembering that an ebook doesn't fit under the tree, although I suppose it does. Thank you. It's harder to picture. Thank you for remembering that Parnassus needs you and you need your independent bookstore. And I am here to, and I'm told this room is just a small sample of the people who are here tonight. I was asked to remember that most of the people here are in some other room. I'm imagining it's like the suite hereafter. So, somewhere watching me on a big TV. Where's the camera? Does anyone know? Is that it? Here? Okay. Hi, sweet hereafter people. You are just as important as the ones who got chairs. Oh, it's over there? Okay. Hi. Oh. Okay. Got that out of the way. A writer, unlike all of you musicians, spends a lot of time alone in a room. And solitude is our native state. And so after spending a year or two or three alone in a room, you turn in your manuscript to your publisher, and they reward you by sending you out on a book tour to a different city every day for a month. So when I named this book Flight Behavior, little did I realize I was going to be watching a lot of people on airplanes. Flight behavior in essence is people trying to stuff 20 pounds of carry-on luggage into a 10-pound overhead bin. That's flight behavior. I'm not going to write a book about that, however. But I have to tell you one good airplane story I left the day after Election Day, and I've been in a different city pretty much every day. Yours is the best. And this is the next to last stop. Tomorrow will be the end of my book tour, but I have to tell one good airplane story, which is that I was in some western city, they run together, sitting on an airplane waiting to take off, and suddenly they announce, well, that we have a problem. The crew is on board, the pilot's on board, the co-pilot's on board, but the pilot forgot his credentials. He left his credentials in his hotel room. Now, I'm thinking, first of all, you know, I'm getting used to this thing of flying and staying in hotels. You have a system, right? You know, I mean, doesn't he do this? You go into the motel room, gels and liquids go here, you know, credentials go here. Do you just walk into your hotel room and go, wee, you know? Apparently, yes. So, which led me to question two, do I want to fly with this guy? Anyway, that might not be the best airplane story you ever heard, but it's what I have to offer. But this book is not really about airplanes, as you know, because the mayor told you what it's about. And so why am I even here? It is about science and faith and modes of denial and farm economics and religion and class and culture wars and climate change. And that's probably enough for one novel. The plan tonight is I'm going to read you about 15 minutes of worth of this book, and then we'll talk. I'll ask you questions, right? It's always hard to pick a tiny part of a book to read because, you know, all of it's there for a reason. So the simplest thing is to begin at the beginning because I don't then have to explain what came before. And because the beginning is the part that you work hardest on. That's the part you rewrite and rewrite, and every day when you write more of the book, you have to go back and rewrite the beginning again and again. So it's fiction doesn't necessarily have a lot of rules. It has some, there are some general rules to writing fiction, like, you know, make sure your reader always knows what you're talking about. Make sure you know what you're talking about. Don't name all your characters names that start with the same letter. So those are general rules. And then I have my own rules that I have devised over the years. And I don't know if they're anybody else's rules. Because, see, we work alone. We don't check with each other that much. But one of my rules, I have about five important rules for myself. And one of them is the first sentence of a novel should make a promise that the rest of the book will keep. So there's your tip. So I'll start at the beginning, and then you'll know. Chapter 1. A certain feeling comes from throwing your good life away, and it is one part rapture. Or so it seemed for now, to a woman with flame-colored hair who marched uphill to meet her demise. Innocence was no part of this. She knew her own recklessness and marveled, really, at how one hard little flint of thrill could outweigh the pillowy, suffocating aftermath of a long disgrace. The shame and loss would infect her children, too. That was the worst of it, in a town where everyone knew them. Even the teenage cashiers at the grocery would take an edge with her after this, clicking painted fingernails on the counter while she wrote her check, eyeing the oatmeal and frozen peas of an unhinged family, and exchanging looks with the bag boy. She's that one. How they admired their own steadfast lives, right up to the day when hope in all its versions went out of stock, including the crummy discount brands, and the heart had just one instruction left, run. Like a hunted animal or a racehorse, winning or losing felt exactly alike at this stage, with the same coursing of blood and shortness of breath. She smoked too much. That was another mortification to throw in with the others. But she had cast her lot. Plenty of people took this way out, looking future damage in the eye and naming it something else. Now it was her turn. She could claim this tightness in her chest and call it bliss, rather than the same breathlessness she could be feeling at home right now while toting a heavy laundry basket, behaving like a sensible mother of two. The children were with her mother-in-law. She dropped off those babies this morning on barely sufficient grounds, and it just might kill her to think of that now. Their little faces turned up to her like the round hearts of two daisies. She loves me not. All those hopes placed in such a precarious vessel. Realistically, the family could be totaled. That was the word, like a wrecked car wrapped around a telephone pole. No salvageable parts. No husband worth having is going to forgive adultery if it comes to that. And still she felt pulled up this incline by the hand whose touch might bring down all she knew. Maybe she even craved the collapse with an appetite larger than sense. At the top of the pasture, she leaned against the fence to catch up on oxygen, feeling the slight give of the netted woven wire against her back. She frowned at the November sky. It was the same dull, stippled ceiling that had been up there last week, last month, forever, all summer. Whoever was in charge of weather had put a recall on blue and nailed up this mess of dirty white sky like a lousy drywall job. The pasture pond seemed to reflect more light off its surface than the sky itself had to offer. The sheep huddled close around its shine, as if they too had given up on the sun and settled for second best. The sheep in the field below, the Turnbow family land, the white frame house she had not slept outside for a single night in 10+ years of marriage, that was pretty much it. The widescreen version of her life since age 17. Apparently, today was the day she walked out of the picture. Distinguishing herself from the luckless sheep that stood down there in the mud surrounded by the deep stiletto holes of their footprints, enduring life's bad deals. They'd worn their heavy wool through the muggy summer, and now that winter was almost here, they would be shorn. Life was just one long proposition they never saw coming. Their pasture looked drowned. In the next field over, the orchard painstakingly planted by the neighbors last year was now dying under the rain. From here, it all looked fixed and strange, even her house, probably due to the angle. She only looked out those windows, never into them, given the company she kept with people who rolled plastic trucks on the floor. Certainly, she never climbed up here to check out the domestic arrangement. The condition of the roof was not encouraging. Her car was parked in the only spot in the county that wouldn't incite gossip, her own driveway. This morning, after leaving the kids at her mother-in-law's, she had floored it for the half-mile back home, feeling high and wobbly as a kite. Went back into the house only to brush her teeth, shed her glasses, and put on eyeliner, no other preparations necessary prior to lighting out her own back door to wreck her reputation. The electric pulse of desire buzzed through her body like an alarm clock gone off in the early light, setting in motion all the things in a day that can't be stopped. She picked her way now through churned-up mud along the fence, lifted the chain fastener on the steel gate, and slipped through. Beyond the fence, an ordinary wildness of ironweed and briar thickets began. An old road cut through it, crisscrossed by wild raspberries bending across in tall arcs. In recent times, she'd come up here only once, berry picking with her husband Cub and some of his buddies 2 summers ago, and it definitely wasn't her idea. She'd been barrel round pregnant with Cordelia and thinking she might be called on to deliver the child right there in the brambles. That's how she knew which June it was. So Preston would have been 4. She remembered him holding her hand for dear life while Cub's hot dog friends scared them half to death about snakes. These raspberry canes were a weird color for a plant, she noticed now. Not that she would know nature if it bit her, but bright pink, the color of a frosted lipstick some 13-year-old might want to wear. She'd probably skip that phase, heading straight for immoral coral and come to bed red. The saplings gave way to a forest. The trees clenched the last of summer's leaves in their fists, and something made her think of Lot's wife in the Bible, who turned back for one last look at home. Poor woman, struck into a pile of salt for such a small disobedience. She did not look back, but headed into the woods on the rutted track her husband's family had always called the high road. As if, she thought. Taking the high road to damnation. The irony had failed to cross her mind when she devised this plan. The road up the mountain must have been cut for logging in the old days. The woods had grown back. Cub and his dad drove the all-terrain up this way sometimes to get to the little shack on the ridge they used for turkey hunting. Or they used to do that, once upon a time, when the combined weight of the Turnbow men, senior and junior, was about 60 pounds less than the present day. Back when they used their feet for something other than framing the view of the television set. The road must have been poorly maintained even then. She and Cub used to come up here by themselves in those days, too, for so-called picnics, but not once since Cordy and Preston were born. It was crazy to suggest the turkey blind on the family property as a place to hook up. But where else were they supposed to go? Her own bedroom, strewn with inside-out work shirts and a one-legged Barbie lying there staring while a person tried to get in the mood. The wayside inn out on the highway was a pitiful place to begin with before you even started deducting the wages of sin. Mike Bush at the counter would greet her by name. How do, Ms. Turnbow? Now how's them kids? The path became confusing suddenly, blocked with branches. The upper part of a fallen tree lay across it, so immense she had to climb through, stepping between sideways limbs with clammy leaves still attached. She smacked her palms together to shuck off the damp grit and viewed the corpse of the fallen monster. The tree was intact, not cut or broken by wind. What a waste! After maybe centuries of survival, it had simply let go of the ground, the wide fist of its root mass ripped up and resting naked above a clay gash in the wooded mountainside. Like herself, it just seemed to have come loose from its station in life. After so much rain upon rain, this was happening all over the county. She'd seen it in the paper. Massive trees keeling over in the night to ravage a family's roofline or flatten the car in the drive. The ground took water until it was nothing but soft sponge, and the trees fell out of it. Near Great Lick, a whole hillside of mature timber had plummeted together, making a landslide of splintered trunks. People were shocked. Even men like her father-in-law, who tended to meet any terrible news with, "That's nothing," claiming already to have seen everything in creation. But they'd never seen this, and had come to confessing it. In such strange times, they may have thought God was taking a hand in things, and would thus take note of a lie. The road turned up steeply toward the ridge, and petered out to a single track. A mile yet to go, maybe, she was just guessing. She tried to get a move on. Okay, I'm going to skip ahead. We'll just skip over the boring parts. Now, if you read this, if you happen to read this book, don't skip anything. Read it all. You should. The last part of the trail was the steepest. As far as she could recall from her high school frolics up here, who could forget that ankle-bending climb, rocky and steep and dark? The air suddenly felt colder. The fir forest had its own spooky weather, as if these looming conifers held an old grudge. What had she been thinking to name that hunting shack for a meeting place? Romance felt as unreachable now as it did on any average day of toting kids and dredging the floor of doll babies. She could have made things easy on herself and wrecked her life in a motel room like a sensible person, but no. Her legs were tired and her butt ached. She could feel blisters welling on both feet. The boots she had adored this morning now seemed idiotic, their slick little heels designed for parading your hindquarters in jeans, not real walking. She watched her step, considering what a broken ankle would add to her day. The trail was a cobbled mess of loose rocks, and it ran straight uphill in spots. With relief, she arrived on a level stretch of ground carpeted with brown fir needles, but something dark loomed from a branch over the trail. A hornet's nest was her first thought, or a swarm of bees looking for a new home. She'd seen that happen. But the thing was not humming. She approached slowly, hoping to scoot under it, with or without a positive ID. It bristled like a cluster of dead leaves or a downturned pine cone, but was much bigger than that. Like an armadillo in a tree, she thought, with no notion of how large that would be. She didn't much care to walk under it. She wished for the glasses she'd left behind. Vanity was one thing, but out here in the damn wilderness, a person needed to see. She squinted up into the dark branches, backlit by pale sky. Her heart thumped. These things were all over, dangling like giant bunches of grapes from every tree she could see. Fungus was the word that came to mind, and it turned down the corners of her mouth. Trees were getting new diseases now. Cub had mentioned that. The wetter summers and mild winters of recent years were bringing in new pests that apparently ate the forest out of house and home. She pulled her jacket close and hurried underneath the bristly thing, ducking, even though it hung a good 10 feet above the trail. She cleared it by 5, and even so, shivered and ran her fingers through her hair afterward and felt childish for fearing a tree fungus. The day couldn't decide whether to warm up or not. Fungus brought to mind scrubbing the mildewed shower curtain with Mr. Clean, one of her life's main events. She tried to push that out of her thoughts, concentrating instead on her reward at the end of the climb. The path steered out of the shadow into a bright overlook on the open side of the slope, and here she slammed on her brakes. Here something was wrong. Or just strange. The trees above her were draped with more of the brownish clumps, and that was the least of it. The view out across the valley was puzzling and unreal, like a sci-fi movie. From this overlook, she could see the whole mountainside that lay opposite, from top to bottom, and the full stand of that forest was thickly loaded with these bristly things. The fir trees in the hazy distance were like nothing she'd ever seen, their branches droopy and bulbous. The trunks and boughs were speckled and scaly like trees covered with cornflakes. She had small children. She'd seen things covered with cornflakes. Nearly all the forest she could see from here, from valley to ridge, looked altered and pale, the beige of dead leaves. These were evergreen trees. They should be dark, and that wasn't foliage. There was movement in it. The branches seemed to writhe. She took a small automatic step backward from the overlook and the worrisome trees, although they stood far away across the thin air of the hollow. She reached into her purse for a cigarette and then stopped. A small shift between cloud and sun altered the daylight, and the whole landscape intensified, brightening before her eyes. the forest blazed with its own internal flame. "Jesus," she said, not calling for help. She and Jesus weren't that close, but putting her voice in the world because nothing else present made sense. The sun slipped out by another degree, passing its warmth across the land, and the mountain seemed to explode with light. Brightness of a new intensity moved up the valley in a rippling wave like the disturbed surface of a lake. Every bough glowed with an orange blaze. "Jesus, God," she said again. No words came to her that seemed sane. Trees turned to fire, a burning bush. Moses came to mind, and Ezekiel, words from scripture that occupied a certain space in her brain, but no longer carried honest weight, if they ever had. Burning coals of fire went up and down among the living creatures. The flame now appeared to lift from individual treetops in showers of orange sparks, exploding the way a pine log does in a campfire when it's poked. The sparks spiraled upward in swirls like funnel clouds, twisters of brightness against gray sky. In broad daylight, with no comprehension, she watched. From the tops of the funnels, the sparks lifted high and sailed out undirected above the dark forest. A forest fire, if that's what it was, would roar. This consternation swept the mountain in perfect silence. The air above remained cold and clear. No smoke, no crackling howl. She stopped breathing for a second and closed her eyes to listen, but heard nothing. Only a faint patter, like rain on leaves. Not fire, she thought, but her eyes, when opened, could only tell her fire. This place is burning. They said, "Get out of here." Up or down, she was unsure. She eyed the dark uncertainty of the trail and the uncrossable breach of the valley, and it was all the same everywhere, every tree aglow. She cupped her hands over her face and tried to think. She was miles from her kids, Cordy with her thumb in her mouth, Preston with his long-lashed eyes cast down, soaking up guilt like a sponge, even when he'd done no wrong. She knew what their lives would become if something happened to her here, on a mission of sin. Her mother-in-law would rain shame on them for all time. Or worse, what if they thought their mother had just run away and left them? Nobody knew to look for her here. Her thoughts clotted with the vocabulary of news reports, dental records, next of kin, sifting through the ash. And Jimmy. She made herself think his name, a person, not just a destination. Jimmy, who might be up there already. And in a single second, that worry lifted from her like a flake of ash, as she saw for the first time the truth of this day. For her, the end of all previous comfort and safety, and for him, something else entirely, a kind of game. Nothing to change his life. The minute he breathed trouble, he would slip back down the mountain and go on home. Nothing could be more certain. He had the instincts of the young. He would be back at work before anybody knew he'd called in sick. She was on her own here, staring at glowing trees. Fascination curled itself around her fright. This was no forest fire. She was pressed by the quiet elation of escape and knowing better and seeing straight through to the back of herself in solitude. She couldn't remember when she'd had such room for being. This was not just another fake thing in her life's cheap chain of events, leading up to this day of sneaking around in someone's thrown-away boots. Here that ended. Unearthly beauty had appeared to her, a vision of glory to stop her in the road. For her alone, these orange boughs lifted, these long shadows became a brightness rising. It looked like the inside of joy, if a person could see that. A valley of lights, an ethereal wind. It had to mean something. She could save herself. Herself and her children, with their soft cheeks and milky breath, who believed in what they had, even if their whole goodness and mercy was a mother distracted out of her mind. It was not too late to undo this mess. Walk down the mountain, pick up those kids. The burning trees were put here to save her. It was the strangest conviction she'd ever known, and still she felt sure of it. Her eyes still signaled warning to her brain, like a car alarm gone off somewhere in an empty parking lot. She failed to heed it, understanding for the moment some formula for living that transcended fear and safety. She only wondered how long she could watch the spectacle before turning away. It was a lake of fire, something far more fierce and wondrous than either of those elements alone. It was the impossible. Now is the part of the evening when you ask questions and I repeat them so that the people in the suite hereafter can hear your question. And if you have questions up there, just, I'm sorry. one more thing I'll say. The very first night that I began this tour, the man who introduced me also introduced the question part of the night, and he said, before you ask your question, ask yourself, what is a question? So, okay, we'll stick with that. So, who's brave enough to begin? Yes. Okay, he said, the first 60 pages are great. No, he didn't. He said, often when he reads my books, I don't know whether it's just my books or other people's books, it takes about 60 pages before he's deeply involved. And the question, because there was a question, was, do I do that on purpose, or do I have the same experience? No, I like it from the get-go. Sir, I think everyone reads a book differently, and I, for me, it's 30 pages, and that's typical. When I read a novel, I give myself 30 pages before I even start to judge, and then after that, I'm harsh. You know, I mean, I don't usually put it down on page 31, but if a book hasn't pulled me in, then I'll put it aside, give it to someone else. It doesn't mean it's not a good book. It means it's not the right book for me. So I think you're asking, when I build a novel, do I expect, or do I somehow presume that it's going to take time for a reader to get into it? Not necessarily. And I think you might find other people, you know, read the book differently. I do, as I mentioned, concentrate on beginnings. Beginnings are very important to me, but I'm laying a lot of foundation in the beginnings. I'm making this promise. So if you know you're reading the promise, maybe you'd like it better. I can only say that literary fiction does build a world for you to go into, as opposed to fiction that's really more that you read more to find out what happened. You know, that you some fiction is more you know, commercial fiction, you know, a mystery. You read it to find out what happened, so you're not likely to read it again because you already know what happened. But literary fiction, I would define as fiction you would read more than once because it's a place you go and visit and you like being in there. Yes. The question was, is it true that long, long ago I wrote in a closet? Yes, it is. Would you like to know why? That was my first novel. I had no idea what I was doing. I did not expect to be a writer for a living. I've always loved reading novels, reading fiction, and writing stories more than almost anything. It's always felt to me like a nutrient that I craved, stories, good books. I chapter books I just consumed. Given that we're in a library, I should pay homage to libraries. Libraries were the temples of my childhood. Even though I lived in a really little town, I'm digressing. I do that. I lived in a really tiny little town, and the library was upstairs above the utility office where you paid your utility bills. And so you go up there, and the librarian was this lady whose mission in life, I'm sure, was to protect the books from children. So you had to sneak around, and that probably added to the allure of the books. But anyhow, I always loved books, reading books and writing stories, but I didn't dream that I would get to do this for a living. So I, you know, wisely enough, prepared for another profession. I studied science and worked as a biologist, and I worked as a scientific writer for a while. And when I was 31, I guess, and became pregnant with my first child, I was awake all the time. I couldn't sleep. I mean, I've never had, I've always had a tenuous relationship with sleep, but then it just left me, it just went away. So the doctor told me, here's what you should do. When you're awake and you can't fall asleep, you should not reward yourself. You should do something you hate. So his suggestion was that you should scrub the grout on the bathroom tile with a toothbrush. And I thought about that for about 10 seconds, and I thought, scrub the grout, write a novel. I'll go for the novel. So I'd been working on this in my mind for a long time, so I stayed up at night for 9 months. I mean, I slept a little bit, but not very much. But it was a chance, because nobody pays you to write your first novel. I'm just telling you. They often don't even pay you to write your second one. But, you know, people often think they would write a novel if they had time. You're not gonna. You got to find it. And that's how I found it. I thought, I can do this at night while my husband is sleeping and the dog is sleeping, and we lived in a really little house, so I pushed my desk into the closet so the light wouldn't bother anybody, and I wrote that novel. And my daughter it was a 10-month pregnancy, because it took me that long to finish the book. She was very cooperative, and I wasn't writing it to be, that was the bean trees. I didn't dream anyone would read that book. I'm not kidding you. I wrote it because I needed to. It was a story I had to tell. And when I finished, I had this pile of paper on my desk, and I had the sort of the notorious fit of house cleaning right before you go into labor. And I was looking around. I thought, I got to get rid of that. I could throw it in the trash. I could put it in an envelope and send it to New York. And it was really, I mean, six of one, half a dozen or the other. I believed, honestly, I swear, I believed the results would be exactly the same either way. But I put it in a mailbox, one of those mailboxes that's much like a trash can. You know, It felt like the same operation. And to my great surprise, it became my first novel. And it became the beginning of my career as a novelist. So then after that, I came out of the closet. Yes. I have played in a band. I've played in a few. Next question. I left Arizona. Yes. I lived for about 2 decades of my life in Tucson, but always I grew up in Eastern Kentucky and always wanted to come home to where my extended family is, and finally was able to do that. You know, life surprises you. You get stuck places. I went to Tucson thinking I would just check it out. I had $22 in my pocket. I thought, I'll see the West, and I sort of had to get a job, and then I had a job, and then, you know, one thing led to another. So anyhow, I loved my time in the Southwest. That was, you know, essentially the second 20 years of my life. And that's where I became an adult. It's where I learned to be a writer. It's where I had my children. Living so close to a border taught me so much about what one country will do to another. I'm very grateful for my time there. And I'm happy to be back home, or will be, in 3 more days. Yes. What are the other Kingsolver rules for writing? The first sentence makes a promise the rest of the book will keep. This is, okay, above that, rule number one is keep a really large trash can beside your desk. Now, that's the old version. Now, the, like, Kingsolver rule 1.0, you know, 3 would be, never mind the trash can, just lean on the delete key. But it's very, very important that I write a lot of pages that you will never see. That's the greatest gift I can give you, is to withhold, you know, 10 times more writing than you get. Writing a first draft is sort of like hoeing a row of corn. You just push and push and push and get through it. But once you've done that, everything will change. Once you do that, then the art begins. It's like a trapeze artist. You sort of swing from this place to that place. Once you've written the end, you can rewrite the beginning, so the language of the beginning somehow already contains the end, like that little germ inside a seed, you know. And you can pull threads of plot and meaning back through the whole book, like, you know, like shiny threads in a fabric. It's like weaving. You get to write it over and over again and throw away the first stuff. So by the time you're done, it's utterly changed, and everything is connected to everything else. So, but you have to be willing to just delete, delete, delete. There are maybe whole scenes that seem perfectly great, but they don't belong in this book. I sort of, as a little cheat, I have like the outtakes file. So if I don't really want to completely throw it away, I'll just put it in, you know, this file. Maybe I'll use it in some other book someday. I won't, but, you know, it makes it easier to throw away. So other rules. One thing I said earlier, sort of jokingly, was, you know, I said, make sure everyone knows what you're talking about. And make sure you know what you're talking about. That's really an important rule. To begin the project by making sure this is something so important that I want to spend years of my life married to this question, to this construction, to this conversation that I'm going to build between myself and you, my reader. Not only that it deserves that much of my time, but that it deserves that much of your time. There's already so many good books in the world, right? Why should I make another one? I need to convince myself first that I'm asking you a question you've never been asked before. That's a very important. Okay, I'm moving that up to number one. That really is the most important thing. And I should give you a reason to turn every page, except him back there. It's not working for you. Oh, poor guy. I'm sorry. I'm just teasing you. Seriously, I'm a great believer in plot. I really love to give you enough to worry about that you'll keep turning the pages. And I'll think of number five directly. Yes, in red. I understand your question. How do you write the grievous things? How do you write the things that hurt so much? She is a choreographer, and she says that she can put those grievous things in movement, but to put them in words would make her cry. And I can tell you, they make us cry. I cry when I'm writing. Sometimes I laugh when I'm writing, not always at the writing itself, but I cry. There are scenes that are so hard. There's a particular scene I'm thinking of in the Poisonwood Bible, and I don't believe in spoilers in case anyone here might want to read that book, but there is a death, and you, this is something you know pretty much from the beginning of the book. You just, you know, it's foreshadowed, but there's the death of a child, and that is, of course, the hardest thing for anyone to contemplate, and it had to be because so much, not just because the plot hinged on it, but because that book was about arrogance it was about what one country will do to another, and it was about the presumption of the Americans who had gone into the Congo, who believed somehow that the same rules didn't apply to the white people as to the Congolese people. And that moment in the book when the white child died was quite necessary as a thematic component of the book, that it was the leveler, it was the moment of proof that the same rules apply to all people, natural laws, laws of civic conduct. So I had to write the death of child. I wrote around it, I wrote under it, I tried to convince myself I could save the baby. I had written many drafts of that book and just left that blank. It was so frightening, but I knew to be true to what I wanted to say about that. I was doing the same thing. I was not wanting the rules to apply. It was grievous. So one day I told my husband, I'm gonna kill the baby. And I sat down and I wrote that scene and I sobbed my eyes out, and I came out of my office and I said, okay, killed the baby. I wouldn't say that writing is a hard life. I would say writing is a lovely life. I love my job. I love it so much. I get out of bed and say, oh, woohoo, I get to make stuff up and they'll pay me. You know, it's a delight. But if you take it seriously, there are moments in the writing life that require courage, and they ask us to rise to those occasions. We rise to those occasions or our work is not courageous work. So that's the answer. Yes, in the green scarf. Talk about the fusion of science and fiction, gladly. As I mentioned, I didn't imagine I would get to tell lies for a living. And I don't think that's what I do. It was unimaginable to me in childhood that I could grow up to be a writer, because in the place where I lived, which is a rural, working class region of Eastern Kentucky, to say you wanted to be a writer would be like saying you wanted to be a fairy when you grew up. I mean, exactly like that, you know, and people would say, That's good, Barbara. Barbara, honey, that's good. I felt quite lucky to get to go to college. Almost no one from my high school went to college. So I felt I needed to do something reliable and valid, and something with that education that would help me support myself. And science is something I love. I always loved biology. I grew up in the, you know, in the alfalfa fields and running in the woods. All my childhood memories involve trees and creatures, you know, like groundhogs, snakes, what have you, and no adult supervision at all. So I loved the natural world, and I wanted to study it, and I studied it as an undergraduate and graduate school. And then, to my great surprise, quickly afterward discovered that because I was also a writer, I was writing all along, and I was writing poems and stories and submitting them here and there, and even started working as a freelance journalist. And I made a great discovery right away. I learned that editors loved being able to send a writer into a lab or into, you know, a research center or someplace where these people spoke, like, you know, the Charlie Brown, wah, 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 you know, they spoke this language that was not very comprehensible to people outside that door of that lab. If I could go in there, interview them, read their reports, and come out of there and write something that was intelligible, even enjoyable for non-scientists to read, that was a living. I got a lot of assignments, and I was surprised and thrilled by that. And so I began as a scientific writer, and I still think of myself as a science writer, but I put science and fiction in my novels. And I think that's an important thing to do, because this book is really about the divides between people, between red and blue, between urban and rural, between faith and science. And I feel that those divides are getting more solidified in modern times rather than less. And I think there is a great need for conversation across these divides, especially between scientists and non-scientists. So I thought that it was just great fun to write a book in which I could put physics in here, and I could write about the ice albedo effect, and the difference between correlation and causation. Really important scientific stuff, but my challenge is to weave it into that novel fabric so you don't even really notice. You just, you know, you're asking yourself, are these characters going to have sex or not? And then before you know it, you learned about the ice albedo effect accidentally. So it's the great fun. Okay, I think I've gotten the sign that we have gone for an hour. Maybe we could take one. I always like to know it's the last question. So who wants to ask the last question? Yes. I do research mostly at the front, it's front loaded. I do most of the research at the beginning, but then as I go, I learn other things that I need to learn about. And so it continues right up to the, you know, right up to the end. And that was a very good question, but somehow it didn't have the finality I was looking for. Okay, I think you have the last question. Yes, 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 you. Okay, no pressure. How do I feel about sequels? Am I ever drawn to return to a landscape? And this is a question that's really trying not to be the last question, right? Can we just never end is the question. The answer is, and I will find a way to make this the final question. The answer is no. That's the short answer. I will never write a sequel, and this is why. I want to write an absolutely new book every time. That's what's exciting for me. When I enter a new book, I figure out the big question I want to ask, and then I figure out the architectural questions or the architectural structures that I want to use to ask this question, and I put stuff into this project that makes it impossible. Every time I create a new challenge for myself, I make sure that it's something that I feel has never been done before, especially by me, but ideally not by anybody, and that seems so hard that I'll never be able to do it. That way, I got to get my butt in that chair every day and prove that I can do it. You know, it's I'm not necessarily a risk taker in my, you know, in my actual civilian life. I have never hang-glid. How do you, what's the past tense of that word? You know, rock clumb. I could go on and on. I don't do dangerous things in my life, but I do dangerous things on the page because it's thrilling. What I want to do is something impossible. That keeps it alive for me. It keeps it exciting and thrilling, and you know, it keeps the adrenaline up so that I am engaged all the way to the end. And I suppose we found it. That's rule number 5 of Barbara's fiction. So in closing, because that was the last question, I thank you for caring enough about books, about literary fiction, to come out here tonight and share this conversation with your fellow Nashvillians. I believe that novels will always be with us. I believe that stories are a nutrient that we all crave, that all humans have needed since the beginning of our time. And I'm very hopeful for the future of books and bookstores and stories that bind people together, because fiction is the only place you can go that will take you to the inside of another person's mind. And that is what makes us the best kind of humans we can be. So I thank you so much for coming tonight, and I will happily sign your books later. Good night.